Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Is 45 FM Los Angeles, 102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren, and we got Mr. David North Martino today.
Oh, it's my whole name.
Yeah, we're doing proper. We're doing it the serial killer way.
Very seriously, you know, today.
It's a dark week this week. We've got Satan coming in here today. Or, yeah, actually, later today. Yeah, we're going to be talking Satan. Oh, and wow. Yeah, that'll be exciting. Haven't heard from them for about 10 years. Don't know what's going on there. Josh Mellerman, of course, later in the week. It's quite a week, quite a dark week. Now, speaking of dark, today we've got a couple of guests that spend their life in the dark. No, just so let's introduce them both, and then we'll get into what they're here for. So, Mr. Dacre Stroker, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be reconnecting with my Canadian roots on this important time of the year. This is the 125th anniversary of Dracula, and my buddy who we meet in a moment, Chris McCauley, we are stoked up. Sorry, I had to say that. Had to be the first to say that, to share our kinds of information with you and your listeners today.
Fantastic. And welcome, Mr. Chris McCauley. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having us.
Before we get into this, like, it's the 125th birthday and all that. How did the two of you get together? Like, what brought you two together?
It's that joke, you know, a Canadian and Irishman walk into a pub. Well, it was close to that. I think we could have. But Chris, I think you're the one that really takes the blame for hunting me down, because you had a really cool story and wanted to see if I want to be involved. So why don't you tell this
one? I'm really glad you thought it was a cool story. I don't know. Look, I wrote that late at night. It was a friend of mine. So it was a comic book anthology that was going out. It was a horror comic book anthology. The publisher came to me and said, "Will you write a vampire story?" And of course, you know, what vampire do you want to write for? It's going to be Dracula. So I created this little story where Dracula was unearthed by a Weyland Yutani style company. He was being tortured, and they were using various properties and manufacturing chemicals and pills and all sorts of things. Dracula gets out and kills everybody, and then jumps in the spaceship and goes off into space somewhere. So I'd sent a little email into to Dacre and said, "Look, I've got this. Here's the script. Here's the visuals. If you don't want me to use Dracula, I'll not use Dracula. I'm very respectful of Bram's legacy and your family's legacy. I studied at Trinity University in Dublin and used to sit under a picture of Bram Stoker. And I was quite familiar with Bram's works." So Dacre sent me an email back and said, no, it's actually not too bad," or words to that effect. And he was like, "Yeah, do you want a phone call?" So we chatted on the phone, and we came up, first of all, with an idea of a series of Bram Stoker short sort of graphic novels based on Bram's short stories. And then it kind of progressed then into this behemoth that is now the Stokerverse, that's all things horror and all things Bram Stoker.
And the funny thing is, Alan, is that he didn't actually have to do that because Dracula is now public domain. But when I sensed that a fellow author, an Irishman, a researcher, a guy that was paying proper homage to Bram and to the family that asked this, I thought there's something special there. And there is. And not only does Chris have an incredibly great creative side to him, but he's got this also respectful side to how to portray Bram, how to Bram's work, how to bring it out. And that's one of the things that I was thinking of. My wife and I run the Bram Stoker estate for our cousins, Bram's great grandsons, who are elderly gentlemen in England and really don't know how to do that. And we've been thinking about how do we get more people interested in some of Bram's lesser known stories. And these were his short stories. And that's when Chris and I really clicked. It was not just the one that Chris was wanting to do on his own, but said, let's collaborate. And Chris knew the mechanics of turning short stories into graphic novels. It's a three-ring circus to get all these guys together and to make it happen. And that's that first one did is called the Squaw, that got turned into The Virgin's Embrace for obvious reasons. That name just doesn't fit in today's time. But it's really a horrifying story. Christopher Lee actually said that, you know, other than Dracula, it's the second most horrifying story that Bram Stoker ever wrote. So we've had good success with that, and then we just, you know, keep going on from there.
Now, when you look back at it being 125 years, do you think Bram would have even thought that this much of a name would have come from Dracula and everything he's done?
The answer is I have obviously no idea. This is one of the interesting things that Chris and I chat about all the time, and as well as other researchers. Bram didn't really take much time in his life to tell us much about his writing himself. He was a humble guy, and he was also totally devoted to his boss, his master, Sir Henry Irving. He ran the theater for him. He ran his whole life for him for 27 years. So everything I'm going to be telling you, or most everything I'm going to tell you today, is speculation based on all kinds of evidence that I found. So I'll just start with the first one. I think Bram Stoker would be really interested, but not surprised, because he put 7 years of work into this novel. It's the only one he really took this long to do. He left us 125 pages of notes, which has given us tremendous hints into his preparation, his meticulous research, the fact that he never went to Transylvania, but he studied it meticulously. He had maps. He had weather charts of all these places where he set the storms and all these other things. One typescript exists that Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, owns, and I've been able to look at that and find out what was taken out at the last minute, what wasn't put in. So I think, based on Bram's approach to this novel, he put a lot into it, and I think he would be very happy that the story that he set in contemporary times has had a really weird and interesting effect on the world. I mean, it is something that, again, Chris and I talk about spirituality, the occult, Freemasonry, all these things that were high on the list of things on people's minds in London when Bram was writing it. They would have been the same people that have come to Lyceum Theatre. He would have known his audience, and he knew exactly what nerve to strike. But what's interesting, guys, is these very same things exist today. People are still concerned and interested about paranormal research, about what happens to the spirit of the dead. Is it possible to come back, to reanimate, you know, even with present science as it is? So, you know, and also to round out that question, he was the theater manager. Who wouldn't love a 125-year run of something? I mean, that's almost better than Les Miserables and Cats put together, isn't it?
Just a little. When you get to the story of Dracula, there's so many versions of it and so many, types of talk about it. What do you think the public gets wrong most often about the story of Dracula?
Well, I think the biggest one, and there are plenty, but the way Bram wrote the story in the epistolary style made it very difficult to adapt onto stage and onto screen. But it was done nonetheless. So at the first point, when people go and say, oh, I know Dracula, did they read the novel or did they see a play or a movie or a TV series? And it's probably nowadays the movie or the TV series. And what has happened there is they have glorified and sort of made sexy the lead figure, Count Dracula. because when this was first done in 1924, when Ray Huntley and then Bela Lugosi came on stage, you would be crazy to put an ugly, gnarly, zombie-looking monster, true monster that Bram had depicted, onto a stage. People would have walked out, or they never would have come in the first place. They were looking for, you know, back in those days, somebody with great, you know, panache and have an attraction. So that is what people get wrong. And, you know, I don't get upset about it. It's just different. You know, you look at the persona Dracula, and it's either Bela Lugosi, Christopher Lee, or more recently, someone like Gary Oldman, or even Klaus Bang, who was in the Netflix production. So they're much more attractive looking. They're more alluring to the females. As Chris and I will tell you, in all the products that we've been coming up with, we're getting back to the basics. We're back to the horrifying, true monster that isn't the romanticized thing that was created because of stage and screen.
Yeah, it looks like so you've got a sequel to the original novel that the two of you've got. So let's talk about that. That's Dracula and the Cult of the White Worm. So what's this all about?
It's set directly after the novel. And we looked at various characters that Bram had created, not just Dracula. The White Worm, which was famously sort of turned into this horrendous Ken Russell film. Fun, but yeah, nothing really to do with the book. And we started looking at Lovecraftian ideas. So we put together, you know, how would Dracula tie in with the White Worm? And I realized that it would be very difficult to portray some of the very vibrant visuals that we would need to do through written text. So it was obvious to go with graphic novel format. There's a company in the UK called Scratch Comics. It's run by a seasoned industry veteran, Shane Chevsey, and he has access to some of the greatest artists known in the UK and US comic book circles. So Decker and I wrote the script, sent it to him. He got extremely excited about it, and it's currently in production. The artist is a chap called Chris Geary, who's been in comics now, I think, for roughly about 15 years. Decker and I have been looking at the ink work that Chris has done, and it's incredible. So it's portraying just the right atmosphere for the story.
Think of this for a moment, guys. If you think of the novel Dracula, and it was edited, a lot was edited out of it because Bram had written such a long story, and even 480 some odd pages was awful long for the day. So what Chris and I have done is we've gone through and dissected the novel, and all these things that were taken out were stories that weren't quite developed. Like, how did Jonathan Harker get out of the castle? We don't know that. You know, how did Mina actually get over to Budapest to save him, and what was that journey like? And then some of these other characters that Bram had mentioned in his notes that he didn't flesh out, the backstories of all the main band of heroes, all these things were fertile ground for Chris and I to write about and to sort of continue with the story with these people and their children. You know, obviously this was a heck of a thing that happened, the novel Dracula, when these band of heroes with no police involvement, you know, managed to banish Dracula and almost kill him and get him back to Transylvania. So obviously, you know, one of the biggest things is if you look at this and we said, we got to justify Dracula coming back. Well, at the end of the novel, this is the novel, not the movies now, Dracula was stabbed with a Bowie knife in his heart and his throat was only slit and he crumbled into dust. There was no wooden stake. There was no complete decapitation and garlic put in the head, just like Bram Stoker said you have to do when they killed Lucy. So we felt we had an open window to continue the story and, without giving you guys spoilers, incorporate a return of this horrible monster to come back and do what he was planning to do all along, which is not just come to London to drink a little blood and, as Chris says, have a booty call. It was, you know, to really take over the world and get involved in politics and, you know, wreak havoc that way.
I think the other thing is is that, you know, Decker and I have incorporated characters that were originally in the novel Dracula, but were redacted And you get to see a flavour of Dracula that you might not have seen in the movies, and indeed in the English translation of the novel. The Dracula was actually a scientist, and created various creatures, which you will see in this comic.
Did you also pull in from the novel The Lair of the White Worm, and what did you bring in from that?
Well, we looked at, you know, this is one thing that Chris and I do, is that we've got to go beyond Dracula to get a flavor of Bram Stoker's understanding of Irish mythology, his understanding, you know, our understanding of the darkness in Bram. And so you're right, David, this was exactly what we looked at is, and because I've got an Irishman here who understands the mythology like nobody else, he's also got a very interesting religious background and a background in Freemasonry that Bram did. Wow. So my writing partner was like, and anytime I mentioned something, he could go into detail. Oh, yes, this is this and this. So it was like, the white worm. You mean that's involved in not only Irish mythology. That, Chris, helped me figure out this is probably what Bram was thinking of all along as the ultimate power, because this is real folklore. And also, sadly, guys, Bram almost took that story to his grave. This was when he wrote Lair of the White Worm, he had had a stroke. He was partially blind in one eye. Wow. It was a favor to his publisher, and it's horrifying to think of this. You know, can you churn out one more great supernatural tale before you go? And that's what he did. He was in Cruden Bay, Scotland, on his deathbed, and managed to write it out. And that's why some people say, well, it's not his best work. It's kind of disjointed. That was the whole idea. Is let's look at some of the other things and what's the connectivity of all these stories in sort of the Bram Stoker web, and let's reconnect them to what we think the audience would like, be it in Dracula or in some of our other products as well.
Now, you've got quite a few different items coming out here, like board games and RPG and stuff. But how do you decide what direction you're going to go into with this?
I listen to Chris. No,
well,
seriously,
it's sort of a joint thing, you know. So Decker and I'll have conversations, and it'll be like, you know, well, this happened, you know, Bram originally wanted this in the novel, and I would take that. For example, in the RPG that's out at the minute, Bram wanted to put a psychic investigator in there. He also wanted to have a subplot featuring a police inspector. We've put those into the RPG as playable characters. So there's a lot of that syncretism that Decker and I have, where it's, you know, my concern has always been, would you think Bram would have liked this? That's the start of it. I mean, I have all these fantastic ideas, but it's the, you know, is this going to feel authentic to the original Dracula? And now, don't get me wrong, you know, we're not rigidly adhering to one form or another when it comes to the stories, but it has to feel authentic. Stories have to feel authentic. So we look at the media. So, like, for example, the audio dramas, we focused in with the characters of Dracula. We looked at their motivations, what they would have felt, how, you know, what they would have observed. For example, Van Helsing, to me, is somebody who he lost his wife, possibly due to some manipulation of Dracula. Dracula wants his revenge on Van Helsing, so that's why he takes Lucy and does what he does to Lucy, because he knows that Van Helsing has a sufficient hubris that he will state, firstly, that he can save Lucy. And Dracula knows that he can't save Lucy. When Lucy dies, then Dracula also knows that Van Helsing has to turn to his friends and say, you know, Lucy's turned into this horrible creature that kidnaps children, a member of the undead, and the only way we can save her soul is to cut her head off and stuff garlic in the mouth. So Dracula's thinking that with that sort of horrendous statement, that Van Helsing will lose his friends and Van Helsing will be left alone. So that's how we go in depth into the mind of the characters. And we look at that sort of level of authenticity. In terms of comic book, it's very much about the visuals and the dialogue. So Decker and I have always strived to have, first of all, the authentic looking Dracula. It is very rare that you get the authentic looking Dracula anywhere. I think the closest was a Christopher Lee film, I think in 1972 or so. But when we describe Dracula with hairs in the palms of his hands, a guy who looks quite vulpine, he's got a widow's peak, he's got a moustache. He's not a very attractive individual. When we describe that, most people don't see that as Dracula. So the comics are a great way to bring that original image back into popular.
Sounds like my co-host.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, we've got a video game coming out, and that's something that is very interesting because it's we're taking now the story of Dracula and we're moving it on into the 1900s and into the era of World War One, and we're able to look at what's happening to Mina. We're able to look at Mina's children. We're able to look at Holmwood's son and other aspects of Dracula mythos, which allows us to sort of push the story on a bit, but again, in a very authentic way. Like, Decker and I think, well, how would Bram have injected these characters and pushed the storyline on if he had set it in 1911?
So this is the game from Spacebot, Chris.
Yes.
You know, one thing about Chris is I think back to your original question, Alan, is he's got many, many hands and many fires. He's a game designer. He's a comic book guy. He's a colorer. So he is in this world that I wanted to enter into. And whenever I come to him saying, as we talked about, how would this part of the story work in a RPG or in a dice game or in a console game or a mobile game, which I know very little about. So I just constantly barrage him with, here's some cool story ideas. Where do you think they would be best applied to? And how do you reach out to, a company, a producer, somebody who would, publish this stuff, create it, publish it, and get it out to market? So Chris just knows that how this whole thing works. I don't. I just know the stories, and he helps me bring them to life.
Well, yeah, I was wondering, too, with Chris, I was just wondering how you designed that role-playing game. Did you have to create new rules? Was there like a pre-made system that you were able to adapt in creating the Stokerverse role-playing game?
Yeah, well, Nightfall, it was with Nightfall Games. Okay. I'm currently doing the Terminator games with them at the minute as well. So they have a skill-based system they use.
Okay.
They use it for their SLA industries. So how it works is that I'll create a story, just like I would a short story, piece of prose. And we would break that down and we would gamify it. And then we would start looking at the characters. What would be a good character to place in here? How do we make sure that the enemies are crafted in such a way that the games master can create a congruent universe that feels, doesn't feel disjointed, but has lots of different elements? I can give you an example of, how we crafted, for example, the RPG that's out at the minute. You get to play as some of the characters from the original book. So, how would that work? Why would Seward want to get involved again in a hunt down for vampires? These guys are going to be suffering from some serious PTSD. They've lost their friend Quincy, and they've been, and they've gone through hell. Well, what we did there was that we had Mina still under the control of Dracula. She goes missing. And then a lady in white is seen walking the streets of London with children. So they automatically think it's Lucy. So Seward thinks it's Lucy and Holmwood thinks it's Lucy. So that brings them back into the game. But it's not Lucy. So that's how we do it, really. It's thinking up, a story, and then motivation for characters, and then putting the skill system in.
And consistency, with, hey, does this follow through with what that person was like in Dracula or in his notes or somewhere else? So we just make sure that they're linked, properly linked to the story.
Now, you found the Lost Journals, I guess, in 2018, and this probably influenced you somehow in a lot of what you're doing. And what did you learn that was a surprise to you?
This is a pretty substantial find. So Bram Stoker's one of seven kids. Of the seven, only three of them had offspring, and only two of those lines of offspring are still alive. Obviously, Bram Stoker had a son. He had a daughter. The daughter was married twice during World War II. Both husbands died, but there are two great-grandsons still alive with some of their kids. One of them, actually, the eldest, has inherited boxes of stuff. Some of the things they decided were better put in the Trinity College archives. This is where Chris went to university as well as Bram, because they've got some substantial holdings there. Other things they wanted to keep themselves. But funnily enough, they kept this journal and they lost track of it. They didn't really know what it was. And one of the reasons why is Bram's handwriting is so terrible. It was a, 173 pages of chicken scratch. And I was over there on the Isle of Wight checking things out because I was doing my research to write Dracula the Undead. And I said, I want to find as much as I can to understand Bram Stoker. I found some letters. I've been to Trinity College. I've been to other archives, museums. And what have you guys got? And they had, interesting little things. But when I found this one, kind of gnarly looking book with this kind of really dusty cover, and the pages weren't even connected to the spine, I pulled this out of a box. It was up in the attic. And I go, holy smokes, if you guys know what this is. And there was no specific dates on every page, like we might keep a diary. It was really a journal where he had just all sorts of ideas that he kept. And it was between 1871 and for the next 13 years. So it was while he was still a student at Trinity College, while he was working at Dublin Castle as a civil servant, and through the time when he started working for Henry Irving. So it was a really important time of his life where he was beginning to show an interest in writing. He'd already been involved in the arts, which is kind of interesting. I was trying to flesh out his place in his own family of seven. See, my great-grandfather was his youngest brother, who was a doctor, and he was very close with Bram. But Bram was not mainstream Stoker family. Three doctors, two sisters, the daughters were artists, and one other civil servant. And Bram was sort of the one that had this leaning towards literature, but he had to go and work as a civil servant, which must have been drudgery for the poor guy, number crunching and detailing with the law and so on. It did actually help him later in his life. But what this journal showed me was a guy who was trying to bust out of a very confined and conservative system. And he was trying to, flex his writing. And that this helped me when I got Dr. Elizabeth Miller from Toronto, who has since deceased just a year or so ago. She was one of the two scholars that did exactly the same thing with the Dracula notes for the Rosenbach Museum, decipher them, translate them, and put them into a publishable novel, along with Robert 18 Bisang, a Vancouver-based Canadian scholar. So those two brought the Dracula notes to the world, and Elizabeth Miller, I co-opted her to help me bring Bram Stoker's journal to the world. And really, it became the playbook, guys. It was what I used. I'm a former school teacher. I could understand the type of person Bram was, how he'd look at the world, what things caught his eye, what things he connected with that he then would use later on in some of his short stories, some of his novels, some of his speeches that he'd give at university in the Philosophical Society, the Historical Society. So it was a really interesting glimpse, the Lost Journal of Bram Stoker, a glimpse inside this person at this time of his life.
Now, when he was a child, too, he was quite ill, and he had quite a few problems, I believe. Do you think this was kind of a basis for the darkness in his writing?
I think it had to be. Again, one of the things he wrote in a book that he wrote about Henry Irving called Personal Reminiscence of Henry Irving, he did give us some glimpses of himself, and that's very uncharacteristic, but he said, in my childhood, for the first 7 years of my life, I never knew what it was like to stand upright, and the opportunity to develop a great sense of imagination was very fruitful in its later years. So how I took that, and with Chris's help, we realized what stories children were told back in those days. And let me just tell you, Irish folklore and mythology was not like fairies like you'd see in Disneyland. These were fairies and banshees and pookas, and these were cautionary tales of you know, life-sucking forces. And they had their own version of vampires. So this, I am sure this had something to do with his very dark sense of imagination. And even it correlates to what he, that little glimpse that he gave us in Personal Reminiscence. And we also know, we have a record of a horrifying tale that his mother told him of her at the age of 12 surviving the cholera epidemic in Sligo of 1832, where half the people died and numerous people were misdiagnosed and buried prematurely and crawled their way out of the grave. And I think that probably weighed very heavily on young Bram at the age of, you know, 5 or 6 or 7, that maybe he was going to be misdiagnosed and shoved into the grave. And, you know, that just reading it makes me develop claustrophobia. And then I'm convinced that he was bloodlet. One of his uncles was a famous doctor that wrote a treatise on bloodletting, which I found on the internet and read. And it told about how these guys in the day would actually treat people with fever. And I think that's probably something that they did to young Bram. Especially, and I say that because, again, evidence that I've pieced together, he actually mentioned in Dracula how when Harker finds the Count lying in his coffin in Castle Dracula, he appeared to look like a freshly fed, gorged leech. So, yeah, does that mean Bram was bloodlet? May or may not, but it gives me a hint that maybe he was and he experienced that firsthand.
That's pretty interesting. Do you now, this is a kind of an impossible thing, but maybe you can shed light. Because quite often when authors write a book and put something together, there is some sort of subtext. There is some sort of point to the story besides what goes on top. Do you think Bram had some sort of a point he was trying to make with Dracula?
There was, I think I want to answer part A of this and let Chris answer part B. So Chris, get ready, because we've had this conversation many times. Part A would be, Bram was a very open-minded person. He had people around him, Arthur Conan Doyle, Mark Twain, other folks in his world that were very interested, sometimes quietly, in spiritualism, in the occult, in the afterlife. And I think that Bram was kind of talking about Dracula as, you know, guys, and this is a direct quote, there are mysteries in life which men may guess at, which age by age we may solve only in part. And that tells me volumes about what Bram was telling us. We may not understand an afterlife. We may not understand a creature that comes and takes blood or takes the life from others. We may not understand the supernatural or people's belief in the supernatural, but there is something there that a heck of a lot of people believe in. In his research, he found over 13 countries that had some sort of belief in the undead. And that's only the ones he found. So this was at a time of a beginning of an enlightenment in British society. This is the end of the 1800s. The book was written to 1890, 1897. There was a lot going on. New science emerging. Electricity was being phased in and gas lighting was being phased out. And what Bram was telling us is there is some, you know, we've got some old supernatural, funky old stuff we've got to be concerned about that's coming from the East. But if we embrace a modern world and modern sense of science, modern understanding, that we can understand it. It won't necessarily conquer it, but we can understand it better. And that's why in his character, Van Helsing, who was like, yeah, he's a scientist, but he also understands mythology and the old ways. So the old ways aren't always bad. And as we look to replace them, we have to appreciate them and understand them and believe in it. Science won't tell us everything. So, Chris, have I kind of teed it up for you okay to give some of your take on it? Because, again, we could talk about this part for hours.
Yeah. I find Bram's work fascinating because I'm a fellow Freemason. So I can see a lot of Freemasonry in the writing. There's a particular phrase that's used in Dracula whenever he invites Jonathan Harker to come into the house, into the castle, and that's used, parts of that are used in Freemasonry. Lair of the White Worm has a statement, you are like myself tiled, which is a Masonic term. So there's lots of those little elements in Bram's work. I think it's not necessarily about conquering the supernatural. As Decker said, I think it's trying to understand it. I'm quite strange because I don't think there's anything supernatural about the world around us. I just think it just isn't fully understood yet. And I think that's what Bram was trying to get to. I mean, you look at, concepts of vampirism, they're very old. The Irish have some of the oldest tales of vampires that appear in bogs. But you also have Egyptian concepts of vampirism, of Isis, who becomes a Set Ka in her vampiric form. You have the goddess Hathor, who was turned into a lioness by Ra, and she went and consumed the blood of people, killed them, consumed the blood of people. Ra took pity upon the world and then created beer. This is actually where beer comes from. Beer. Wow. That was in the form of red, yes, and then Hathor lapped up the beer and then went to sleep. So there's a lot of old tales, and we don't really understand them fully. Literature always helps us do it in an abstract form. And I think that was part of the genius of Bram Stoker, that he was able to take those concepts, abstract them, and make them into damn good stories. Every writer has a point to a story. It's not just cool. There's a reason why you write things, sometimes in a very subconscious way. And I think for Bram, a lot of it was to do with stories that he was told. I think him being ill and being incapacitated as a young man had a lot to do with the fostering of his imagination. There's actually particularly well-written bits in Dracul that I love that show that, where he starts to have the imaginings and all sorts of things happening. That's what draws me to Bram's work. The attempt to elucidate the supernatural in literature.
Your new items coming out. You've got a war game. Let's talk about that. Where does that come from?
So, Crooked Dice are a brilliant company that deal with miniature figures and wargaming. And they have this concept called 7TV, and basically it's like TV shows that have never been seen before. So the idea is that you would go down into the vault of this TV station and find these video cassettes, and they're all sort of like TV shows that have never been aired, but are based on things that have been aired. So Dracula was a natural fit for them. They loved the idea of having this complete version of Dracula that's never been shown before but was filmed. And that's the basis of what the war game is going to be about. So taking elements of the novel, Bram Stoker's novel, and changing them and placing, little game, little wars, sneaking missions, things like that with the little miniature figures. And Decker and I were getting an update today about it. It's all very exciting.
Chris, isn't this is the group that used the students from Edgehill University, right? Is that correct?
Yes, they use interns, they use literature interns to sort of investigate and research and look at the motivations in the books, and then they faithfully turn that into the game.
I was asked to put together a lecture for them, which I actually do all over the world. So Chris and I did one of these sort of Zoom things with the slides. And I have to tell you, I have never had as many high quality questions, feedback after this. Actually, it was during the 1 hour that we gave to Edgehill, and they've invited me to come back sometime in the fall to follow up. So what I think is cool, having been a high school teacher myself, is how this company is actually utilizing university students, interns, as Chris said, to get some really fresh ideas, you know, great young thinkers to get integrated into making these stories with us. So, yeah, we're thrilled to death to be working with them.
You've got two of your own books out, and when we think about that, what got you interested in actually putting these books out? And I would say, coming from your family history with Bram, didn't you feel a great deal of pressure on doing such things, like to release your own books in the same subject or area?
Well, yes. My standard answer, and then I'll give you the inside scoop, is, you know, being a Stoker and being related to Bram Stoker, it does open up a lot of doors. You know, as anyone will tell you, trying to publish something traditionally these days with a big publisher, you've got to stand in line. You've got to, you know, the stars have to align to get that manuscript into somebody's hand to get them to look at, and it goes up the chain and finally get to somebody who, you know, realizes this is worthy of this particular publishing company. And the name helped, but also what I found quickly was, if you don't live up to that name, the door will be slammed awful quickly, and in a more merciful manner by the reviewers, and especially not just the professional reviewers, but by the general public on Amazon and Goodreads and so on. They will generally look at somebody, oh, he's just trying to capitalize on his family's name. And, you know, to me, that was disheartening, because I was coming out of my comfort zone in both cases, writing Dracula the Undead with Ian Holt and having Alexander Gallant as our historic researcher. You know, that was the labor for me to hold up my end, to do the research, to be able to provide information to these guys, to write some of the passages myself, text blocks and so on, to depict Bram Stoker, how he can be inserted into the continuation of Dracula. And then, you know, that was 2009. And then I learned an awful lot going forward for writing Dracul with J.D. Barker. Is, number one, we needed to write it in the epistolary style, which Dracula was written that way. We didn't do the undead that way. And so in finding J.D., that was gold, because he could write that way. But we also made sure that I said, darn it, I'm going to be beyond reproach. You know, I take it personally, which I shouldn't, and most authors should not, when you see these reviewers go, oh, he's just capitalizing on the name. He should be crucified at the next family gathering, you know, stuff like that, if they don't like what you're writing. And so I think as a result, you know, we wrote a pretty darn good book, and it was, you know, one of the top five in the country. It was the top, you know, in the U.S., it was the top selling horror hardcover in England. It's been optioned by Paramount, and it's a prequel to Dracula. So, you know, as I said, it can be a blessing and a curse. It gets you in the door, but it doesn't guarantee success. And it actually, I think, makes people look at the work a little bit harder and rake you over the coals if they don't like it.
Well, I think you also found it, you know, extremely important to, from what I was reading, to get Dracula back associated to the Stoker family name.
Yeah, you're right, David. Although it's already public domain, but I still wanted to have something that was, you know, Stoker-esque about it. Plus the fact that with each of these different writers, all the research that I did, I found bits and pieces that have helped me and Chris. Some of the things we didn't put into these novels, but I found so many interesting little snippets that didn't make it into Dracula, or things about Bram that could be integrated into these two stories, that I wanted those things associated with Dracula, things that were connected to the family and Bram's original research. And heck, in Dracul, I've got some of his own brothers and sisters in the story. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. Bring some of those guys to life. Because, for instance, I knew darn well that Bram Stoker's eldest brother, who was a very famous medical doctor, who was knighted Sir William Thornley Stoker, did all of the medical the medical advice to Bram during this story. You know, the brain surgery on Renfield, the bloodletting and so on, the type of instruments to use. So by golly, he was going to be a character in this story, as was his sister, who I'm sure that Bram kind of merged his mother and his sister to create Mina. So that's why I felt that Stokers had to get back involved in this effort.
So let's talk about how people get a hold of you guys or how they find all these new products and stuff. So let's start with Chris now. How do people find you?
Pretty much anywhere.
address, phone number, like what's...
Yeah, so yeah, we've got Stokerverse Facebook group. We've also got Stoker Macaulay Facebook group. We've got our, I've got a website, dark-legacies.com, for all the older bits and pieces that I'm doing. So that's how you get a hold of me.
And I can be found, you know, same pages, Facebook pages, Chris Havant, and I've got Dacre Stoker author on Facebook, and then I've got dacrestoker.com website. And then my wife and I run bramstokerestate.com, which actually has all the books that have been published, and any of the products like the Bram Stoker bobblehead and other cool products are all in the signature store at the bramstokerestate.com. And we also have information that people loan us about Bram Stoker that we want to share with the world, other researchers that have found cool things. So we're all into sharing, but also selling stuff as well.
What's your most exciting product for you coming out? Like what are you looking forward to the most?
Oh, well, just going into these new games that Chris is talking about. I mean, the RPG game is great. I mean, I've yet to play one. I guarantee you I'm going to play one of these RPG games. But I also really like, as you can see on my behind me, you can't see it, but guys, trust me, I've got these little miniature figures I love to correct.
Yeah.
So the crooked dice stuff, I'm looking forward to that. And I've turned into a bit of a junkie when it comes to the comic books and graphic novels. So all that stuff, just line me up. I'm going to be like a kid, you know, going out to the store. Just like my grandson who wanted to come in and hang out with his grandfather here is like, I want to see all this. You know, literature is great, and I love getting into a book, but I also love all the cool ephemera and stuff that goes with it, all the games and things as well. I'm looking forward to it. And, of course, 125, May 26th, you know, I'm going to be in Crudengay, Scotland, you know, celebrating the place where Bram Stoker wrote the novel with a civic reception put on by the Aberdeenshire City Council.
And, Chris, what are you looking forward to?
All of it. it's strange because I'm sort of the cool face of this, managing all the various companies and all the things going on. But I think everything's very exciting. Everything that Decker talked about, and then you know the video game for me, it's a fascinating process. It's going to be done in a sort of a Castlevania action style, and that's something that I'm really interested in, because I think I love the fact that people will be able to play a part, I have to be careful what I say, but a part of the original novel that was not published. Wow. as a prologue to the game, and then continue on the adventures of the characters of Bram Stoker in the main game. So I don't know if you guys have ever played Castlevania, but that's pretty much what we have in store for people.
Well, that's something to look forward to. We've got lots of activity coming up. So, of course, we'll have everything up on our website, and everyone can find you easily that way with one click. And, again, it's been a real pleasure and a thrill, and we thank you for coming on the show. Celebrate your 125th birthday.
Do I look that old?
Say, you know, you're doing pretty good for 125. You know, but that's all that blood drinking.
Yeah,
it is. It's a lack of sunlight and the blood drinking. Well, Chris is the vampire in the group. I'll tell you, the guy never sleeps, and he's uncanny with all these things he understands. He's got the power of 10 men and the intelligence of it as well. So, guys, thank you so much for having us on. Appreciate
thank you.
It. Yes, thank you. Thank you, folks. Really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino movie reviews.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com. houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.